Blog Talk Radio. far across the sea. Let us all swear allegiance to a land that's still
country loved. Have mercy, Molly. Thy liberty, yeah.
Well, they say that the country's done. They say that the stock market's gonna crash. They say that every single one of us is gonna lay down while they walk across our back. But I'ma stand up. Gonna put my fists in the air. No, I don't wanna have to bring my guns, but I'll be ready if it goes there. But
your thousand blushes off the rose. I've been working all my life, but that's just how it goes. It's not just getting older, though God knows that's a blow. I don't care. Get one shot at life. At least that's how I feel. I've got to stake my claim right now and dig for something real. Standing on my own in life been difficult, you know. I don't care. Find the one you love, then seal it with a kiss. Put on your favorite music, lie back and feel life flow. Oh yeah, now you're letting go. You're letting go.
Source of my courage and wisdom, You taught my spirit to fly. Flow, river, flow, soothing my soul. Flow, river, flow. Song of life, music that dances within me, painting the darkness with light. Peaceful and quiet river, you are my special friend. You're always there when I need you, faithful and true to the end. Flow, river, flow, soothing my soul. Flow, river, flow. Flowing through heart and mind, source of my courage and wisdom, you taught my spirit to fly beyond the sky, beyond the sky.
Me.
God's gentle voice divine. Trusting in you I go forward, leaving all doubt far behind. Peaceful and quiet river, flowing through heart and mind. Source of my courage and wisdom, you taught my spirit to fly. Flow, river, flow, soothing my soul. Flow, river, flow. Song of life, music that dances within me, painting the darkness with light. Peaceful and quiet river, you are my special friend. You're always there when I need you, faithful and true to the end. Flow, river, flow, soothing my soul. Flow, river, flow. Flowing through heart and mind, source of my courage and wisdom, you taught my spirit to fly beyond the sky, beyond the sky, beyond the sky.
And welcome to another edition of Continue Mission. I am your host, James McCormick. We had, we always have microphone issues. You can buy a new microphone. You can run tests on it. And let me tell you something. This is Murphy's Law right here, folks. This is what happens. I guess I'm coming in loud and clear now. Okay, well, welcome to another edition of Continue Mission. We are going to be discussing, the history of the 4th of July. But we're also going to be talking about the difference between humility and pride. Yeah, so anyways, with that being said, I want to, I'm still working on our audio right now. So if I've got echoes, I've got people out there that are letting me know. So if I don't have echoes, are we good? Okay, all right, folks, we're good to go. All right, so. We're going to talk about the 4th of July. We're going to go into this real basic. Then, of course, we're going to bring our historian on. We're going to discuss the history of the 4th of July. And then we're going to go into where Father Michael is going to take us through the difference between pride and humility and a whole lot of other things to boot. You know, it's an interesting fact that, you know, a lot of people have come to accept this, you know, a form of arrogance. And I remember when I was growing up, I was always told, don't be too proud, don't be too proud, don't be arrogant, don't be bombastic, Don't be a braggart. A braggart was some of the worst things you could be. And now it seems to be not only accepted, but it is, it seems to be almost encouraged, especially among some of our politicians. And when we look at that, we think about, you know, why did we even have to come to the point on the 4th of July? Well, things were a whole lot different back then than they are now, and I'm sure that we can get into that. But some of the things that were occurring were troops were taking over people's houses. You know, there was, slaughter of the on the frontier that was encouraged by the British to bring the Continentals into heel, for a lack of a better term. And there was just a lot of things going on. But primarily it was because of taxation without representation. So essentially they were forced to pay taxes, heavy taxes. And they didn't have a voice. They really didn't have anything. You know, you think about, you know, let's think about Puerto Rico. A lot of debates about Puerto Rico. You know, look at how many Puerto Ricans, have served in the armed forces. But, you know, they're not a state. They don't have the same benefits or protections that states have. You know, so a lot of people could say, well, you know, that's pretty rough. That's pretty raw. So that's, they're looking for statehood. You have a lot of different debates out there. But still, it is nothing was compared to what we were going through under the crown. And it was not a good time to be in continental America. To not look at this and compare it to what we're dealing with today. Now, I hear a lot of people say January 6th, you know, that was like the 4th of July. That's the most insane, craziest thing I've ever heard in my life. Number one, it failed miserably. Number two, you know, it was more of a rabble. And to even compare it to the 4th of July does such a disservice to those wonderful patriots that signed that document and gave up their fortunes, in some cases their lives. None of them went unscathed. And I can tell you, John Hancock, you know, signed his name in great big bold. I mean, it was almost like he was giving the king the middle finger when he did that. And it was just kind of an interesting way to look at it. But I'm going to have Rich on here. He can tell you a little bit more about it. Because today's actually a special day, because this is when it was actually the 2nd of July, when it was actually voted upon. So, Rich, you got me now, don't you?
Yep. Well,
all right.
Actually, if you look at how we celebrate the 4th of July, what happened is on the 2nd of July, the Continental Congress had gotten together and voted on independence. And then 2 days later, they started cooking barbecue hot dogs and hamburgers and decided the 4th should be the day we celebrate.
Rich.
Actually, what happened is that there's a letter John Adams wrote to his wife after the vote. They voted, and it was a slim margin, okay,
mm-hmm.
a slim majority, and he said that we would be celebrating, from then on the 2nd of July. Well,
right.
What happened is once they agreed to the independence, they had to write a document. So they asked Thomas Jefferson to write it, and then John Adams and Ben Franklin would review it and make corrections, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the actual Declaration of Independence we have. And there's a no, – I mean, it was 2 days of writing and revisions. The language was very, very specific. You know, we had the discussion about, critical race theory. And the question was, you know, all men created equal or all Englishmen created equal? Okay, there's a difference. And
right.
Keep in mind, Thomas Jefferson was a Southerner. But everybody else were, you know, New Englanders, and the Quakers and Massachusetts, what are those guys up there? They all had slaves. They had slaves. But they had realized, you know, we're going to create a whole new government. It's time to start over. Okay. So they made it all men are created. And this, a lot of it, the language was inspired by John Locke, who was a philosopher from the Age of Enlightenment. And John Locke and Montesquieu would, a French philosopher of the Enlightenment, would, I mean, literally, Thomas Jefferson, I mean, as eloquent as those words are, the guy plagiarized. He was borrowing. He had 2 days to knock this thing out. There was another study of just that. And he was just borrowing language that was already out there, okay? And
right.
So that's why we celebrate the 4th, is because the 4th is when everybody signed their name to the document. And,
sure.
And, you know, there's several aspects of it, but the main thing is America had become different. You know,
right.
A number of us, you know, thought that we were still British citizens, but a lot of them had realized they weren't. And keep in mind, they, with the exception of the South, Virginia, Maryland, and the Southern colonies, everybody else came here to escape the religious persecution of England. They wanted to create a new world. They wanted to create a world based on their religious starting over. It was to escape that. And so all this was building up, and it came to a head, you know. And here's something to be aware of. You know, when we rebelled in 1775, if you look at the history of mainly Scotland and also with the nobles of England, you know, when they get the upper hand, what usually happens is the crown negotiates. The crown negotiates. And we get see, at that time, no one could envision living without a king. The Scots wanted their own king, okay? But the idea was the history of England is uprising, but they all settle it. You know, when one side gets the upper hand, then, okay, we come to some kind of agreement, and, you know, we'll give you some more rights or something like that until we decide to take them away, whatever. But in America, while England may have fought, well, this is just another disagreement. We can settle it out. When the Americans declared independence, that was a shocker.
Well, you know what? I think few people have really actually read the Declaration of Independence. And you know, when a lot of folks will say, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And then, you know, then they go on to that whenever any form of government becomes destructions of these ends, you know, this is what you hear now, you know, being said, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it. But they cut out everything else. And I think that here what really is why we needed to be free, because the history of the present king of Great Britain is the history of repeated injury and usurpation, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. And then listen to some of these things. He has refused to assent to laws, you know, the laws that were established for them, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance. He was a micromanager. He has utterly neglected to attend to them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in legislature, a right inestimable to them and formable to tyrants only. He has called together legislative bodies of places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of public records, He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly. He has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers incapable of annihilation. He gutted the whole form of government that was established here. He has refused for a long time to do that. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states for the purpose of obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners. So remember, we are the land of the immigrants. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing his assent of laws for establishing judiciary powers. He has made judges dependent on his will alone. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. He has kept among us in times of peace, standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He has affected to render the military independent and superior to the civil power. Imagine that, if the army just rolled in, then you can say you're oppressed. You know, they roll in, they just take over. You know, police have no power. I don't care. You're out after 9 o'clock. You know, we're going to arrest you, maybe shoot you. I don't know. He has kept among us the standing armies. He basically has a fit to render the military independent and superior to civil power. There was nobody to complain to. He has combined with others to subject us to jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us. Remember that. They mentioned that more than once. You know, that must have been a huge, huge issue for protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for murders, which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states. They were killing people. The soldiers were, you know, they were, you know, going into people's houses. They took whatever they want. They take your wife. They take your cow. They take whatever. You know, that definitely is a reason to revolt. For cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, essentially forcing them to only get things from England.
Yeah.
Imposing taxes on.
That's the thing about the British soldiers, I think you're exaggerating. The British saw us as British citizens, and it's the Hessian soldiers they were really upset with. They're the mercenaries that didn't identify with us, and they're the ones who were abusing property.
Yeah,
Keep in mind, if you were identified as a patriot, they would burn your home, no doubt. And the same thing is the patriots were burning the homes of the loyalists. So there was a lot of that going on.
Well, there was obviously murders and rapes that were occurring in massive numbers
I'm now down the first person accounts, the journals.
Yeah.
And that maybe with the Hessians, but I'm not thinking that. I think the British were very, very civilized in their conduct of the war. You got to understand, the bulk of the war was major battles. But these light infantry and skirmishes, and it was over foraging.
But when you look at the Declaration of Independence, obviously they had a big gripe because they named it for protecting them, for quartering large bodies of armed troops.
Yeah, and that was standard. But, you know, keep in mind, that was standard practice for the British Army.
Yeah.
Was you didn't have barracks when you went in to occupy something.
Yeah.
You quartered the soldiers in homes. In fact, our Rangers, when they went to train with the British commandos, they were quartered in people's homes in Scotland.
Sure.
And in fact, they were told, you know, they were assigned a place and all these local families would put up one soldier. And that soldier had to be, you know, your community.
But you see the problem that they wrote is, and that's what I'm focusing on, is just these things. And then we're going to go into it, but by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on inhabitants of this
these states?
Well, so to really simplify it, okay, those are the extremities of the problem is that the king believes he gained his authority from and because and of that, it was unquestionable. And so even though there was attempts to restrain his power, he would abuse it. So, you know, all those things like, disregarding, local laws or judges and stuff, it's because he believed he gained his authority from God for that didn't matter. And he could appoint anybody he wanted.
What I'm saying is this is what's actually in the Declaration of Independence.
Right. Those are what's called the grievances. Yes.
Right.
Those are the specified grievances, but they all come from one thing.
Destroy the lives of
king,
people.
The king believes his authority comes from God, and he doesn't have to answer to the people.
Here's the last one.
Let me point this out, because I've been doing a lot of reading on this. Okay. As I mentioned, John Watson.
I wanted to get through all the grievances, and then I was going to hand it over to you.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so that's what I wanted to do, because people don't read this, so they don't understand. So they go through and they read the first part of it, and they say, oh, I feel like I'm being abused by the government. Well, okay, let's go down and let's take a look at these grievances. And I'll tell you, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27. And the last one, and I just want to kind of read this. Basically, he has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us, plundered our seas, ravaged our coast, burned our towns, and destroy the lives of our people. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries. This is what you were mentioning right here. To complete the works of desolation and tyranny already begun with circumstances of cruelty. And you know, this is pretty powerful thing. And then he has constrained our fellow citizens taken captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren. So that was pressing people into service.
It was primarily the British Navy. They had a real recruiting problem. So what they would do is they would pull aside, capture a American merchant ship, and then impress some of the sailors into their service.
Now this last one that they put on here. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us, that's the Native Americans, and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless and savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. That there's no doubt that those things really happen.
And in fact, let me tell you, that's why we had the problem with the French in Canada, because they didn't have large standing armies. They armed the Indians. They were allies with the Indians. And the Indian rule of law is not our rule of law or warfare. It's brutal. The Indians were trying to push back the frontier, so they were taking the war to civilians. And we were very offended by the French, and then the British go and employ the same tactics against us. But here's something I want to point out, and you did a good job of counting the number of grievances, and what's in the Declaration is that, you know, yes, we are going to have grievances with our government. That's not by itself a reason to, you know, separate ourselves from it. It is that it has gotten so bad that it's become irreconcilable. And keep in mind, this thought, this whole idea that you can declare your independence from the crown is an Enlightenment idea. That is from I mean Montesquieu, who was writing about the fact that when, and he wrote about different kind of governments, okay, the Republican government, the monarchy, and so on, aristocracy, and he points out, he says, purpose is to provide, you know, safety and protection for the people, and John Locke is the one that talks about safety or, you know, in pursuit of happiness. Well, anyway, but it's Montesquieu that when the government fails to produce those things, then it have the right to dissolve that government. So there's a if you look at that Age of Enlightenment, that is the inspiration. That is the justification. That Declaration of Independence is the culmination of this Enlightenment thought. Government, you know, the monarchy is no longer serving is benefiting us, and we need to now have our own government. We don't know what it's going to be, but what we have is not going to work.
Yeah,
but but as you pointed out, it's not one. See, today, as we are in a time of civil strife.
Well,
yeah,
I mean,
so just because you don't like what, you know, the president, or you don't like what's going on, that is not a reason to dissolve the government. How many grievances did you count? Serious grievances.
27
serious grievances. And as you pointed out, the worst one was pretty much declaring war on your own citizens. Okay, I rest my case. That's what that Declaration of Independence was all about.
Yeah.
That's why it's such a significant document.
Yeah, and I wanted to, and you know, and look, our country came about through war. I live in a state that was separated during the Civil War. I mean, obviously, warfare has been part of our lives. You know, we had, you know, it was tested in the Civil War, and you know, thank God we were able to secure it. You know, thank God it was, you know, secured here recently. You know what I mean? And people don't think about this, but this wasn't the only time. I mean, we had riots and we had problems, you know, right after we, you know, gained our independence, you know, the Whiskey Rebellion. And there was, you know, there were
the Shea Rebellion. Yeah.
I mean, so with that being said, you know, happy 4th of July, America. Don't waste it, you know, on frivolous things. You know, go out and really study the history. Really read the Declaration of Independence. That's my advice. And sit down and think about some of these grievances. I was very fortunate. You remember, Rich, you know, the bicentennial. You know, 1976 was an awesome year. And it was a time, you know, that I was educated at a very young age about, you know, the independence of America. Every day there was something on television. You only had three channels back then, man. You had to get up and change it. You know what I mean? And it went off at like 12 o'clock at night. It's not like it is today. That's why I kind of like, you know, watching. I guess we have become a nation that, you know, we're very comfortable. We're extremely comfortable, you know. We really haven't had a whole lot of sacrifice.
Too comfortable. Hard times make strong men. Strong men make, you know, good times, and good times make.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, look at the World War II veterans. They were all out of the Depression. Those were darn sure hard times. You know, I was raised.
Yeah. And they created the greatest period of prosperity. No other time in American history that we had a large middle class. And what did we produce? The baby boomer generations that got protested against their parents, the establishment, and thought they could do better. And we are now living with the damage that has been done.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, here's what I'm going to say.
That's just my take.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, we're going to go into kind of a really good discussion. I got Father Patel on here, and How's it going there, Father Ficella?
Very good, very good. Thank you for reviewing a lot of the declaration. I spent some time this week. I just wanted to just draw my attention to two things, because we always talk about, you know, endowed by their creator. But at the end, it says, we therefore, the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world.
Right.
And then later on at the end, and for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Doing real good. My wife and I were married in 1976 and came back from our honeymoon and refused to go into Philadelphia because of the big bicentennial celebration. But it certainly was a wonderful year in many ways, and that's why I couldn't be with you last week. We were away celebrating our anniversary.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And happy anniversary. You hit a
Thanks.
Landmark, you know. Most people
Sir.
Hit a landmark when they get married. Now you hit a landmark.
Amen. I have some
Go
stuff
ahead.
Here for you on with a question that you raised about,
yes.
And it's very interesting when you talked about King George and, you know, how John Hancock responded. It's interesting when you look at the Tocqueville and the way he looks at the French Revolution in comparison to our revolution. I think there was some hubris and lack of humility on behalf of the English. And if you would allow me, I'd like to talk a little bit about how important that is. And as I mentioned to you in correspondence, the army is now implementing humility as a value. And this is brand new, and I think it needs to be understood properly. I mentioned to you and Rich that, you know, humility is not thinking less of yourself less. And we talk about, you know, sacrificial living, selfless living, even as regards our military service. But there's also an issue that I would like also for us to talk about, and that's the false pride and the fake humility, you know, where we're not really showing true humility. You know, for some people, and I'm not saying this to be fresh or anything, but some people have a lot to be humble about. And there are others that want to come across as if they're humble, but they're really not. And, you know, humility signifies lowliness or submissiveness, and it is derived from the Latin humilitas, or as St. Thomas Aquinas says, from humus. In other words, the earth which is beneath us, you know, being down to earth. You know, things of that nature. But if we look at that as weakness, just like we look at meekness as weakness, and it's not at all. It's strength under discipline. It's like taking a heavy box and you're able to put it down because you're strong enough to not just drop it. So, you know, David the king even said, I don't involve myself and things too difficult for me. I think part of humility is understanding the parameters of what you're really capable of doing, not only morally, but also regarding your competence. I mentioned in one of our exchange that when you're competent, you can have confidence. But when you're not competent and you're insecure, usually people overcompensate and they become arrogant. And I really want us to look at that. There's nothing wrong when you're really good at something because you've worked very hard at it. You're competent that you can have confidence. That's not the same thing. Now, the Apostle Paul said, I put no confidence in the flesh, because the confidence he had was in Christ and his perfect sacrifice for humankind. So there's a whole lot of discussion that we can have. You know, the deadly sins, the first one is pride, and the antidote is humility. And, you know, what does that really look like? Is it just saying, you know, I'm nobody, I'm no good, you know, I'm just, you know, a fingernail on the body of Christ or whatever? No, not at all. That's not humility. See, God became a person, put on the uniform. And, you know, we can be down to earth, but we don't, you know, Jesus, the scripture says, thought not equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he humbled himself. He was God, but he didn't go around saying, I'm God, nor did he deny that he was God, and he did the works of God. So I want us to get at what is true humility. Obviously, King George was acting arrogantly the way he was treating our country. And I really enjoyed going over the Declaration as you instructed and just seeing some important things. But, you know, Lucifer had a problem, and we can see this in Isaiah chapter 14. He wanted to be God. And see, there are a lot of people, and someone said it this way, humility in a higher and ethical sense is that by which a man has a modest estimate of his own worth and submits himself to others. See, we learned that in the military, from the heart, not just externally, that we look at others even better than ourselves. That doesn't mean that we disdain or despise ourselves. But I think some people think they're being humble, and really it's fake humility and false pride. So I want to get at the real crux of what it is, so that we can walk humbly with our God. The scripture says, he has showed thee, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of thee? Do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. So if we could kind of take some from there.
All right. So I think I was 18 or 19 when I went to jump school. And I remember having this discussion with Chaplain, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about humility. And here I am. I'm this young paratrooper. I was in Special Forces, and it was all about pride in the street. And the conflict here, and I struggled with this for many years. When I say I struggled with it, it's like it's a debate that, look, as I matured, I learned humility. But I'm telling you, when I was young, the thing is, we use pride and esprit in to make a unit, a cohesive fighting unit or a functioning unit. If it's, because I was the Army Transportation Corps historian, whether it's truck drivers or boat drivers or whatever, it is this. We use the history to build pride and esprit. Airborne, what is the purpose of airborne? Is you got to be a volunteer. The course is designed to weed out the weak. And, you know, after I became a paratrooper, I had to look, you know, we heard the joke of the guy who writes home to his mother and said, Mom, I'm sorry, I can't talk because you're a leg. We don't know whether that story is true or not, but that attitude permeated. We're going like, if you weren't airborne, you weren't shit, okay? Now, we definitely didn't have humility. Why did the Army try to build us up that way? Why, when we go into you, we tried to build pride and esprit? Because we want these guys to think they're better than they are. Football coaches, what do? Do they teach their football team to be humble? Maybe in victory, but no. They want them to walk into that stadium thinking they're the biggest, baddest people, the team on that field. So now you've already answered the question, but I'm twisted it around. So what's your response to that?
I think our humility is a disposition to accept our impoverished dependence upon God. I think what you're saying as a boxer, and I know the many times I was in the ring, yeah, it's not a time to say, oh, I'm no good, this guy's so great, I'm not going to beat him. No, there's some sense of being confident. You know, but Paul, who could be confident because he was brilliant, he had such pedigree, he realized that compared to his relationship with God, it was rubbish. It was dung. So I get what you're saying, and that's a good illustration with the football team. You know, I played a little bit in high school, but yeah, you want to pump people up, you want them to perform, but you don't want them to be so arrogant that they look at other people as peons. And I think
especially
that's
their
what
mother.
We're seeing with King
especially
George. Yeah,
mother.
Right. But that's what we're seeing with the king, who doesn't understand that he too is accountable to the judge of the whole earth.
So you brought up the martial arts, boxing. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in physical pain right now because of humility. All right. I've spent my whole life training in the martial arts and the last 25 years in Aikido. And there's this big debate about Aikido is a bullshit martial art, won't work against any other martial art. So I accepted that challenge. Now, I come from a mixed martial arts background. But here's the thing. You know, I fortunately had good training. And I was taught that whenever you enter a dojo or a dojon or whatever they call the school, you got to forget everything you've ever learned before. You got to walk in there as a blank slate, mm-hmm. being ready for someone to write upon you. Which
yes.
means for you to ignore all your previous experience, that requires humility. And what happened this mm-hmm. week is I'm now going around looking for other martial arts schools to train, and there was one I've had my eye on. Now, one my son trained in, I already had a rapport with the owner. I knew, you know, he knows me. He knows I'm an Aikido instructor. Many of the instructors knew me. The student instructors knew me. Well, that was 10 years, 11 years ago. I could, you know, I can walk in, play with them. They know me. But because I coach some of them. But there's one that really looked good. So I went over there, and I approached the Muay Thai instructor. And now you got to understand, you're going in there, you're going like, okay, so you're an instructor in another martial art. You want to come in and test your skill level. You know, there's some great videos about guys going in to try to prove themselves and challenge mm-hmm. the instructor and get humiliated, okay? Humiliated. The thing is, if you really, first of all, you want to go in to learn, and then you want to go in, learn about yourself. You have to go in humble. But that comes with, as you mentioned, confidence. At that point in my life, I'm like, I know how good I am, and I know how good I'm not. And there's areas that I'm weak in. I'm very, you know, I'm good with my hands, but I haven't sparred a real fire in a long time, and I definitely don't have any experience with kicks. So I approached the guy, and I'm bowing to him, and I told him my situation, and he goes, yeah, sure. Like 7 o'clock, that's sparring night class, okay? And, you know, we put the gloves on, the shin guard, and I went through his training, okay? And I, you know, I held my own, or did that. I tell you, I still worked out on the bag. My training program was good because when it came to get both boxing and Muay Thai, which is kicking, and for the boxing, I was really good. I mean, it was just, I was back in all the moves and stuff like that. But with the Muay Thai, that's where I got beat up real bad, and the instructor twice, okay, and he was good. And still, the thing is, the way they were holding their hands, I could get the hooks, but I'm not going to do that for two reasons. One, you never try to embarrass or the instructor in front of his students. Never do that. Never do that. They're just a code of respect, okay? And because I've watched that happen, because people who've tried that, they get punished real bad. Usually instructors usually lose control at that point in time. So the thing is, you go in there and you play with them and you try to learn from it, okay? And I got a lot out of it. I got, besides the bruises to my left thigh, I learned a lot from this, okay? And what I wrote him afterwards and I said, you know, I'm willing to pay the money to train with you for a month. Teach me how to do this, how to counter this kid, okay? Because that's my weak area. But for the hands, it was really good. But there's a case for the and special forces. When I was in back in the 70s, there was a poster, and it showed me there in the center of it, and it says, "The Green Beret will say more about you than you will say about yourself." That was humility. But you had to get to that point. You know, you look at everything you had to get to wear that beret required a lot of maturity. And once you got there, you talked about confidence. When you finally get to the point where you're like really, really good, then you can be humble. But the issue is because here, General Miley is, and I think that's why James wanted to bring this up as a topic of discussion, is because General Miley wants to add humility as one of the Army core values. And I'm going, humility is, I think humility is something you have to grow into. You have to mature to be humble. You have confidence. You, as an 18, 19, well, let me tell you right now, I'm going to tell you, the 18 and 19-year-olds today, my kids, these young soldiers, they don't want to listen to what the old people have to say. They have no humility. They think they already know everything. They have to figure out, know this stuff before they start listening to their elders.
But
they have no humility.
Let's talk about humiliation a little bit. I think that when you've been humiliated.
I've experienced that a lot.
Yes. You see, there's where you're going to learn humility. There's someone always better. Okay, I've got my ribs cracked. I had one kid in a judo class take my head and bang it on the head on the ground a couple times. But Scripture says, if we humble ourselves, God will exalt us. If we exalt ourselves, God will humble us. And there are times, Rich, that God will humiliate us to teach us to be humble. And sometimes
you're talking about daily life. I have learned that lesson the hard way. When I start thinking I'm in control, that's when I find out I'm not.
But even in the ring, when you think, you know, I remember when we tested for black belt and we had like people surrounding us and you had to get called out and so on and so forth. And there are some people that are very strong, you know, very talented. And you realize that there's always somebody stronger. There's always someone faster. You know what I'm saying? And so you have to have a proper estimation of yourself. It's not like you're putting yourself down. You're just assessing yourself realistically. That's a part of humility, that, you know, someone sings better, someone's better looking. You know what I'm saying? And so when you put yourself and you think that there's no one that can touch you or no glove that can touch you, after you get knocked out, then you realize you weren't, you know, there's a level of humility. And sometimes, as you have said in the past, we learn more from our failures than we do from our successes. And so I think you can have hubris, you can have arrogance even in the ring, but if someone, you know, knocks your block off, you know, it's going to kind of make you gun shy and you're going to be a little more careful as you go into the next situation and guard yourself more or whatever the situation might be. And what I'm trying to say is that we don't want to have to get to the place where others or God has to humiliate us because we refuse to humble ourselves. And like you did going into that dojang, I want to learn from you. Okay, that's, we always can learn no matter how much we know, whether we go to Michelangelo as an artist or whatever. There's always something. I met with a professor this week, 52 years he's been teaching at William & Mary. He was very interested in my dissertation, and we discussed a number of different things. He's a brilliant man, a chemist, chemistry professor. And I just think that we can be confident and competent, but we also have to understand our limits. None of us are perfect, not only talking about morally, but, you know, whether it's shooting, I don't know, were you always an expert? Did you always get 100%? I mean, I just think that we have to have a proper assessment of ourselves and try to improve from that place. But when we walk around like no one can touch us, I remember we had this guy, he was from Newark, New Jersey, and he was bullying everybody. You know, he came with his, you know, high collars and this and that. We had a kid in my class with a cleft lip, and he was a younger brother of several brothers, and we were in the gym locker room. I'll never forget, this guy was in there pushing himself around. This guy cleaned his clock, and believe me, you, he walked around a lot humbler than he was when he came from Newark. You know what I'm saying? And so
yeah,
that's all I'm saying is that. Mm-hmm. For a second,
well,
that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, but we can talk about our experience. You know, why I went to theater school. I mean, it's a cool tap. But I'll tell you right now, it had nothing to do with arrogance or pride of spree. It was, I did not want to have to look up to anyone who had that tap, so I had to have that tap myself. And as you know, mm-hmm. I'm a West Point graduate of Special Forces, and I love Special Forces. It was one of the best parts of my life. I don't boast about it, but tell a lot of stories because I had a blast. Okay, I try not to look down on anyone, and so.
It's easy to. I know when I was at Fort Bragg.
Well, no, the thing is, it's kind of like once you've done it, you don't have to brag about it anymore. Okay, so tell me what Ivy League schools did you graduate from?
And that's what I'm saying. You can begin to feel, you know, because I graduated from Yale and Harvard, and I was able to go
and Cambridge,
to Cambridge.
You got your PhD, ABD from Cambridge.
Okay. And you know, but you can begin to think, you know, I'm in a class right now at Harvard, and brilliant people, the professor's brilliant. And now they've allowed me to share from my perspective, and I'm learning so much. The reading load is really intense. And what I'm just trying to say is we know what we bring to the table. We know, you know, what we're good at, what gifts God has given us. We know what we know, but we know what we don't know. And what I'm saying is that we just want to not, and you use the word boast in a bad way. I mean, even Paul, he was going crazy talking about his pedigree and, you know, talking about who he was and everything. But he realized in comparison, and he also says, whatever I have received, it's been given to me from the Lord. And even some of your physical prowess, your intelligence, all those things, whether they came genetically, they're still endowments and gifts, Rich, from God. And that's why
we
give him the glory.
Okay, so what's that? So let me ask you that then. All right, so when I use history, the airborne, all the commando schools, or except Special Forces and stuff, are designed to build this pride and esprit to make a unit a much better fighting unit.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the purpose of humility? Okay, so when I ask that, look at your own background.
Mm-hmm.
You're a Harvard, Yale, and Cambridge graduate, okay? But you are the most down-to-earth person I've ever graduate from those schools. What's the purpose of humility?
I think
one thing is you don't
to God, run. You realize you're limited. that you're not. In other words, if your standard is others, then you can compare. But when your standard is Jesus, then you realize that no matter.
Yeah, but Father Michael, I would say 70% of Americans don't believe that stuff. So if you're saying, I want to be a good Christian, I need to be humble. Well, 70% of the people don't believe that, so they don't need to be humble. But here's
what
the thing
happens
I believe
when you're
is,
not humble, you get humiliated in different areas, and you begin to realize that life can be harsh.
All right, let me ask you this. So if everybody you encounter, you let them, first thing when you meet them, that you let them know that you're a Harvard, Yale, and Cambridge graduate, what's that going to do to your relationship with them?
Probably make them feel that I'm bragging, or make them feel that I'm trying to make them feel inferior. And there are times, I think, where you have to share your experiences. Like when I teach police officers, so who's this priest that's going to talk to us about ethics? Well, I have a postgraduate degree from Harvard in ethics, just war tradition. I've studied and taught laws of war in the Army, you know, the Geneva Hague Convention. So I think sometimes just because you have credentials, it gives you credibility, but you're not saying you're better than people, because when I teach those classes, I learn from the students.
Right.
That's, my
that's you. That is your philosophy. And I subscribe to that too. And for example, the Army History Program is anywhere from 150 to 200 civilian historians, okay? And one of the historians, Dr. Richard Stewart, is a retired colonel, military intelligence, got his PhD from Harvard, Harvard or Yale, one of those two schools. And he lorded it over me. And, you know, I heard everybody else complain about that, how Richard Stewart would – I mean, it was always up front. You know, I got my PhD from Harvard, okay. I'm much better than you. I mean, you get that, to, as you said, to establish that inferiority. And I'm like, I've met him several times. He never said that. And then one day we were at the Conference of Army Historians, which CMH puts on, and one of the lecturers was interesting, and I it turned out he was a West Point graduate. So I was out in the hallway talking to him afterwards, and then Bill Epley, who was another historian program, came up. So the three of us are, Bill and I are sitting there talking to this guy, picking his brain and stuff like that. We're talking about his lecture. And Richard Stewart walks by, and he looks at us. He says, well, there's our three West Point graduates, and walks on. And I'm like, oh, that's why he never rubbed it in his degree in my face, because Ivy League school equal to Harvard and Yale. And but the fact is, I'm going, he's paying attention to that stuff. The point is, it was there. It was not – I did that because I didn't want to have to look up to anybody, but I never wanted to look down on anyone. That's humility.
Right.
But so if any, it was also the PhD thing. I never got my PhD, but I've got like right now 8 books published, and I always
you help
everybody.
Me get mine.
You yeah, help you're me on get your way. Mine. So I'm sitting there, but my point is there was a number of in the field. The guys with the PhDs would often rub that in the nose of those who had the Masters of Arts in history. They go, "Well, I got a PhD," and that was
but
always out front.
PhDs get their you help two people, as far as I know, get their PhDs.
Yeah, no, that's true. But see, that's me personally. That's you shouldn't have brought that up, because that's the left hand telling the right hand what it's okay. I wanted to take with me to my maker. But the thing is that whenever, because a lot of the guys with the PhDs are not published authors. And whenever I heard my peers complaining about guys with the PhDs, you know, lording that over him. I said, I am waiting for someone to bring this topic up. You only have a master's. And I said, well, how many books have you got published? And no one ever did, because one, there was two things. One, okay, now I'm bragging. Okay. Humility is something I can't talk about. I'm not a good subject matter expert on that because I don't have it. So anyway, the point is like, I got 8 books published. How many do you have? Okay, because that's what it really counts. Your degree doesn't mean anything if you can't get published.
It definitely does. I told you I was applying for a job at Harvard, and my former advisor said to me, this is before I got my PhD, said, don't have that he has is that you haven't published a book. And, you know, now, Lord willing, that's going to happen for me, my actual dissertation. But you're absolutely right. I know another guy that was offered a job, or he at least went for an interview at Cambridge, and he only had a master's degree, but he had published, and he was architectural. He was on lighting or something like that.
Right.
But he had published 2 books, and they wanted to talk to him. Now, he didn't get the job, but because he had published, it meant as much to them as if he had had that advanced degree.
No, yeah, that my point is, getting published trumps a PhD. And the thing is, No, I never lorded that. I never lorded it. In fact, I ended up helping people like you and
right.
the callers, okay, on helping them get their dissertation written. So in respect to humility, is you mentioned confidence, right?
Mm-hmm.
Confidence comes from achievement. So all these things, once you achieve those, you get these achievements, you develop confidence, you no longer have, I believe this whole, it's a process. I think you actually have to start out when you're young. You have to build pride in the street, but you got to be humiliated because, like when you talked about martial arts, I always sought out the guy who was better than me because I wanted to beat him. Because I would spar with that guy. My sparring partner was always better than me. And when I finally got to where I could beat him, I sought the next guy out. Okay?
I did that with running.
So the idea was –
younger and better. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm seeing it as – so when General Miley is saying we need to add humility as one of our core values, I go, well, you know, that's something you grow into. If you want every soldier to be humble, you want them to be humble in victory, but they have got to have pride and esprit to achieve that victory.
But, Rich, what is fake humility? Let's just talk a little bit about this. Some people think they possess it, and it's really not true humility. And I think that if you have the counterfeit, it's kind of like getting inoculated. You get a little bit of it to keep you from the real thing. And I find that there are people who think putting themselves down, for instance, that's humility. You know, that's a bad self-image. That's kind of accusing God for not, you know, giving you what you should have. You've heard this statement, we can't put in what God left out. But I think that sometimes we think it's humility when it's not. You want to address that?
Well, no. That's one of the things I kind of – well, actually, I think you should explain it more, okay? So
yeah.
How would
okay.
someone think they're humble and they're actually not, right? Actually, I just texted you and said we're down to like 8 minutes now to the end of the show.
Okay.
And we need to wrap it up. James,
go ahead. James?
Go ahead.
Okay,
go ahead.
Sometimes people think if they have their eyes down and, like I said, they think less of themselves, that's not being humble. But it is thinking of yourself less because you're outward focused. You have a mission, and it's not all about you. You're not narcissistic. You realize that you contribute, you have something valuable to bring to the table, but you're not the whole team. You know, you've seen these guys that are quarterbacks, and they think because they've got a great arm, they're the whole team. Well, you know, if those linemen don't protect them, they're not going to get a chance to throw that ball. And sometimes I think linemen have to teach quarterbacks that. Let's see how great you think you are. That's what I'm talking about. So we pretend that we have something that we don't possess, and it's not the real deal. It's fake. It's false.
Right.
And you know, that is something, as the interesting thing is this, I think that, you know, the generations, you know, my grandparents were, you know, products of the, you know, the Depression. And I remember one of the things that they taught us, and, you know, as children, was to not be too proud. You know, the pride was looked upon as, you know, good in small doses. You know, it's kind of like, it was explained to me is, you know, when you go to sit down and you eat, you know, you intake of protein is supposed to exceed the intake of sweets. And pride was something that, you know, it was okay to have pride in your appearance, pride in your job, but to not demonstrate it. The whole humbleness. And how I learned this is, you know, I was a football player and I was, you know, a scrapper and not a bad one either. I was a pretty good nose guard. And so my grandfather walked up on me one time while I was out talking to some friends, and I didn't realize he was behind me telling them, you know, how great I was. So anyways, he kind of stood there, and I watched my friends, you know, kind of looking. They saw him. I didn't see him. My grandfather was a mountain of a man, and I felt that big hand come down on my shoulders, and he just looked at me, and he said, "Now, son," he says, "now, was there anybody else on that team?"
That's right.
And so it made me, and then I got to talk, you know, and then, of course, there was, you know, pride comes before the fall, you know.
That's
all
right.
Of these things, you know, and I don't, you know, look, if you'd come to my house, you know, I have some accolades, but you won't see them. You know, I mean, Rich has been to my house. There's pictures of my kids, and I think I got one or two pictures on the wall, not much. You know, we don't really have a lot of stuff just because that's just the way that I was brought up. It doesn't mean that because someone has a shadow box on their wall or, you know, that they have a little pride in their service that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that you're right. There is a lot of fake humility. There are people that are thinking that, well, if I just put on this, and it's kind of like a show. But then I think there's a lot more of the opposite, Father. I think that there is so much more of this, the me, the
hoopers.
And we need more of the we, you know. And I don't know, it's just one of those things that's just been very, very, you know, very drilled into me heavily from a young age up. And I just wish other people would see it that way. But it's okay. It's okay to have pride in what you do. It's okay to know that you're good at what you do. But it's not okay constantly, you know, remind everybody about it. And
can I?
Yes, sir.
In the minute that we have, can I tell a quick joke about humility?
Please.
Go ahead.
Absolutely. This guy was given a medal for humility in Sunday school, but they took it away from him because he wore it.
All right, here's mine. There's no I in team. There
Amen.
Is
That's right.
There is
there
a
is
me
a,
in team.
Yeah, there is a me. Yeah, backwards. Yeah. Well, you're right. But the, you know, and again, we don't have much time, but it is interesting to hear this. And I think that our listeners, you know, enjoyed this presentation tonight. You know, the key takeaway on this is just treat each other with dignity and respect. And, you know, don't be something you don't want anybody else to be or do. You know, as we go through life and navigate all of these wondrous things in life, we realize that sometimes, you know, we have to take our lumps just like anybody else. The amazing story is Father Michael, you are right about, you know, that humility joke. Boy, the minute that you even mention something that you've done, you know, there is always somebody there to try to, you know, accuse you of being braggadocious, and that should be the greatest thing from all of us. The key,
you know, I think
love.
The problem is hubris. You know, where you're really arrogant and, you know, try to be superior to others. You know, I think we've all probably talked about, you know, our achievements, but I think once you start making people feel like you're better than them, that's the sin.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. And with our last minute and 13 seconds, saying everybody, thank you for joining us tonight on Continue Mission. Take an opportunity, every opportunity that you have, to do something good, say something nice, and remember to love your neighbors, you love yourself. That's a hard thing to do sometimes, but you got to do it. That's what God wants us to do. So, friends, have a wonderful evening. God bless each and every one of you and your families, and thank you for joining us tonight on Continue Mission. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night. Happy 4th of July.